I think the golf course business actually has been getting a lot better over the last year.
Hi, I'm Ivanka Trump. In the real estate business, the word luxury is terribly overused.
My dress shirts are 100% cotton, ensuring you look sharp all day long.
My passion for beauty, design, and fashion inspired me to create the timepieces and fashion jewelry.
When it comes to great steaks, I've just raised the stakes.
The Trump family's business empire has been years in the making, and it's taking longer than promised for the president to extricate himself from some of those businesses. Ethics lawyers have sued, and now critics have another issue. Last weekend, the president boarded Air Force One for a weekend at his private resort in Palm Beach, Florida, a trip that cost taxpayers an estimated $3 million. His son Eric recently traveled to Uruguay to meet with real estate executives there. That cost taxpayers over $90,000 to put Secret Service and embassy staffers in hotel rooms. While Eric worked on selling condos branded with the Trump name, part of the Trump Organization, which the president has still not divested from. And that's only one layer of Trump's potential conflicts of interest. Here to untangle some of them is Joshua Voorhees, senior writer at Slate. Hi.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Well, so the president was at Mar-a-Lago over the weekend. He attended a fundraising gala when he was there. He saw family. He made work calls. And that's not really rare, right? A lot of presidents do mix business with pleasure. But is this different?
Well, yeah, I mean, I guess generally speaking, some of this isn't that unique at all. Presidents always go on vacation. I mean, you could point to the fact that Donald Trump complained every time that President Obama went on vacation, but that kind of hypocrisy is a little bit separate from what we're dealing with here. And I guess that issue is, since the president is going to properties he owns, he's kind of using the White House as a marketing vehicle. When he shows up at Mar-a-Lago and he rebrands it the Winter White House, I mean, he's very consciously doing that, knowing that he owns this property and he's selling this brand. I mean, we saw just before the inauguration, membership in Mar-a-Lago double for the new initiates. And I mean, I think it's pretty clearly the reason why he thinks that he can double that price. And it's because the brand is more recognition. And that obviously stems from the fact that he's president now.
Now, what about the Secret Service on that trip? They presumably stayed at Mar-a-Lago. So are they comped rooms, or do taxpayers pay for them to stay in rooms that Donald Trump owns?
So it's a little complicated, the Secret Service, for obvious and I think fair reasons. They try to keep things pretty specific, the specifics of their trips under wraps for kind of security reasons. They don't say where they stay, but I think it stands to reason that the Secret Service would want to stay as close to the president as possible, and therefore they would be in Mar-a-Lago. I can't say for certain whether Trump comped their rooms, if they in fact stayed there, but I think knowing what we know about Donald Trump and his business, I think you could safely say he probably did not. One kind of related factor here is with Melania Trump staying in New York City, for at least for this first year as his son finishes up the school year, that the Secret Service is going to have a pretty severe and prolific kind of security presence in their building. And they reportedly in the fall were looking at leasing an entire floor of Trump Tower. I mean, by default, that money is going to the Trump Organization, which is owned by Donald Trump. So any money the Secret Service would be paying to protect the first family, therefore, is ending up in the pockets of Donald Trump, which might be unavoidable in the situation with Melania staying behind, but it's still incredibly problematic.
Right. And that is obviously taxpayer money.
Yes.
So, but what about these promises to divest or at least put his holdings into a trust, not a blind trust, but a trust?
Yeah, I mean, that was pretty much just all for show from what we can tell. He had his lawyer kind of came out and I think the words she used were completely isolating himself from the organization. But since we've discovered ProPublica kind of they did some creative FOIAing and got their hands on kind of the document that outlines how this trust works. And the revocable Donald J. Trump revocable trust is exclusively for Donald Trump's benefit. And on top of that, it's, as the name implies, revocable. He can pull it at any point. So he can claim that he's not making the day-to-day decisions at the Trump Organization. And he says that those decisions are being made by his two adult sons and a third longtime executive. But ultimately, he's a silent partner, but he's still a partner. And he has control over that. If he wanted to decide tomorrow to fire his sons, he could do that. So I guess one way to look at it is he might it's fair to say that every day he's not making that decision. He's making a decision to keep the power structure that he has in power. So while he might not be explicitly or actively managing, he still is the managing partner de facto, if nothing else.
Mm-hmm. And let's talk about this trip that Eric Trump took to Uruguay and what it reveals, because it was reported that there were some State Department officials or staffers, at least, on that trip. So was that mixing of government and business interests right there?
It certainly seems to be. It's been unclear exactly what role the local embassy played in the event. I think of the roughly $98,000 that we know were spent on hotel fees, the vast majority, roughly 90, were the Secret Service. And that is, while problematic, perhaps understandable. We know that there was another, I think, roughly $8,000 or so that came from local embassy staff coming over. And they're, by definition, diplomatic staff. According to the State Department, they were playing a kind of an undefined support role. And I think the problem here is, I mean, if Eric Trump is going on a business trip and he's showing up with both Secret Service and surrounded by diplomatic staff, then all of a sudden this business trip just comes with this unmistakable sheen of a diplomatic one. And I think if you're a local buyer of a condo in Uruguay and you see that, and certainly the way the local press coverage reported on it, I think it would be incredibly difficult to kind of somehow hold these two competing and thoughts in your head that this is Eric Trump, the son of the president, in town, but this is not Eric Trump as part of an envoy of the president, especially given that he was making that business trip literally in the name of his father, mm-hmm. who is the president.
Right. Now, what about the daughter, Ivanka Trump? She was supposed to have removed herself from a position of power within the Trump organization. Has she done that yet?
The paperwork's been a little slow to come out on both kind of her removal and the president's. Since then, we've started to see the paperwork filed. It's certainly the Trump organization, broadly speaking, is kind of this Russian nesting doll of LLCs and a bunch of other variety of interesting financial instruments. So it's pretty difficult to track down each individual one. But generally speaking, they're registered many in New York, Delaware, and Florida for a variety of tax purposes. And we've started to see them filing the paperwork to separate themselves, at least in name, from the company. But again, I think it's given that this company sells and trades on the Trump name and given their ties to their family and that they're still profiting off these things, I think it's arguable to say whether they can ever fully separate themselves from this business.
Mm-hmm. Now, Melania Trump yesterday announced a lawsuit, or her law firm did, against the company that owns the Daily Mail. And the paper in England ran a story claiming that she had spent some time as an escort before meeting Donald Trump. And the lawsuit says that the story damaged her ability to capitalize on her once-in-a-lifetime position. Are they saying that that position is as first lady?
I think they're pretty careful in the lawsuit not to mention the presidency, but it's pretty clear from the wording that that's what they're talking about. I believe they refer to her as this over the next multi-year period that she'll be the most photographed, or one of the most photographed women in the world. And I think there's only one way of reading between those lines, and that's that they're talking about her as first lady. And while I think it's important to note here that in this lawsuit, she's talking about opportunity, not actions. So while it's this giant red flag about how the Trumps see the White House and see its kind of its intertwinement with their business, they haven't actually taken, in this specific example, they haven't taken any steps yet. But I mean, I spoke with Richard Painter and Norm Eisen today. They're the two former chief ethics lawyers for both the George W. Bush administration and the Obama administration. And they're incredibly concerned and I think safely to say infuriated by the idea that here we have someone using the public office of the presidency pretty clearly, at least designed for the idea of their own private good.
So what about this emoluments clause that we heard so much about in the Constitution, that a foreign entity cannot pay a president, right? So what's happening with that in terms of people looking at his possible violations of the Constitution there?
So this was kind of the first place that we saw some movement in within days after the inauguration. By the reading of the emoluments clause that says that the president can't be receiving any money from either a foreign government or a state or a company controlled by a foreign state, and it's very clear that Trump is in this case that he's in violation of that. It's never been tested in court, so it's kind of up in the air, the Trump reading, which I generally think is pretty weak, and so do many ethics lawyers. But ultimately, they're going to make their case. But the first lawsuit came from the two men I mentioned earlier, Richard Painter and Norm Eisen, and it's the biggest hurdle that case has, and they're suing him in New York court, and I believe the appellate level. And the argument there that could kind of derail this case is that they don't. It's unclear if these ethics experts have the legal standing to sue. In our court system, generally speaking, you have to be able to prove that you're specifically economically harmed mm-hmm. by this action. And it's unclear exactly how these ethics lawyers and government watchdogs are harmed. I know the ACLU is also kind of on a parallel track and hoping to find kind of a local hotels, both in D.C. most likely, and I would imagine New York, that can make this case that these foreign diplomats are coming into town and specifically choosing Trump hotels over their own because they know that it will get themselves in the good graces of the president.
So then those hotels would be the harmed party and they would bring the suit?
Yes, but as far as I know, the ACLU has declined anyone to sign on. I think that is unfortunate, but almost unavoidable. I mean, if you were companies tend to be pretty hesitant about taking on the administration, especially one that has made a president that's been so clear that he's willing to target very specifically companies and call them out on Twitter and elsewhere, where I think it could be some time before a company is willing to kind of to risk what they would need to in order to file that suit.
Joshua Voorhees, he's a senior writer at Slate. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, the border between the U.S. and Mexico has received a lot of attention from President Trump lately. He wants to build a wall there. He says terrorists are pouring over that border. But FBI reports show more suspected terrorists trying to enter the U.S. through the Canadian border. The Daily Beast obtained the FBI documents. Jonna Winter is a contributor to the Daily Beast. She's a freelance investigative reporter in Washington. Hi.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Good to have you. Well, these are 7 monthly reports from the FBI Terrorist Screening Center that span from April 2014 to August 2016. And what did you learn from them?
Well, I learned that despite all of the focus by the president on the huge threat to the southern border, there's actually almost twice, or in some cases more than twice, the number of known or suspected terrorists trying to enter from the north. So the data completely, I mean, I found it shocking, but it seems like maybe, according to my sources, they are perhaps looking at the wrong border, or at least the northern border deserves more attention if you're talking about where terrorists are trying to sneak in the country.
What is the definition of a known or a suspected terrorist?
It is, I mean, there's obviously been a lot of criticism over the years over the massive sort of ever-expanding terrorist watch list here. So known or suspected terrorist means, I mean, certainly legitimate people who are directly connected or suspected of terrorist activities or whatever associations. And the rest of them, frankly, my sources indicated are people who happen to be from a certain country, perhaps traveling to a location where there is a community that tends to be more heavily surveilled by federal law enforcement. For example, some of the reasons why we're seeing higher numbers on the Canadian border is really because of convenience. I mean, if you are traveling from Somalia to visit your relatives in Michigan, you're probably not going to fly through Mexico City. It just does not make sense. Mm-hmm. So a lot of it is if you are coming from a country that is considered to be more likely to be housing some sort of terrorist sympathizers, and you're traveling to a community in the U.S. that is heavily watched, I would say, you're probably going to be included in that. And also, being included in any of these watch lists that are searched for this category of known or suspected terrorists, that doesn't preclude you from entering the country. It sort of, in some cases, people are straight up turned around and not granted entry. But in other cases, it's like, okay, well, we're going to ask for more documentation, or we're going to ask you more questions or write down more records about who you say you're visiting with, and we're going to check up on those people.
Okay, so I guess I'm wondering, what are there different ways of checking people at different border entries? In other words, is it uniform or not when it comes to the northern and southern borders, when it comes to checking people who are on the so-called terrorist watch list?
It should be, in theory, for sure. I wouldn't speak to exactly what is happening on both sides, although I did talk to the head of Border Patrol for basically all of the northern states. And I've spent a lot of time covering the southern border. So in theory, what should happen is you apply for, say you apply for a visa, you apply for asylum at the border, you actually have a valid visa. Your name gets run through a series of, like, the TIDES database. If you're traveling on a domestic flight or international incoming flight, the airline is actually in charge of submitting the passenger manifest names to the FBI's, like, big center of sort of terrorist information. So at all of these border crossings, that should be done in the same way. And so each law enforcement agency, Border Patrol and ICE and FBI and local law enforcement, all are supposed to report their encounters with anyone who's a known or suspected terrorist, meaning in any of these watch list databases, to the FBI, and that's how they come up with these monthly encounter reports.
But when you're talking about the border and crossing the border, people fly in to cities that aren't along the border, right? From and that's how most people come into the country is
right. And if you look at the reports, there's a much higher number of overall encounters on domestic, which means they're already in the country, or incoming international flights.
Right.
The land border crossing percentage is just a small part of that number. I mean, in August 2016, for example, California had 19 encounters at land border crossing. And this is out of a total of 77 for the month. So
most flew in.
Yeah.
Who were on the list. Right. So, but in those land border crossings, is there a different standard for, let's say you're going to come across Toronto and, on that border crossing, or Detroit? Is there a different standard there than there is?
There shouldn't be.
In Texas.
And I haven't heard report that there is, so I should be clear about that.
Okay.
But the definition of land border crossing also includes people who are caught crossing the border not at checkpoints or ports of entry. So it's sort of a large category. But yeah, I mean, everyone should be processed in the same fashion.
Right, right. So what are people saying with all this focus on the southern border? Are they worried that would-be terrorists are now thinking they have an opportunity to cross along the northern border?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think these reports show, at least since 2014, and the people who have worked the northern border since far before that, show there already has been a focus by terrorists coming in from the north. And it doesn't take, that much of intelligence to figure out that, if you're a terrorist and you're trying to sneak in the country and all you see on TV is Donald Trump talking about building a wall and having more resources and getting all these new Border Patrol agents to be stationed at the southern border. I mean, I would think they would try to go to the northern border, and that's what my sources have been suggesting.
Jonna Winter is a contributor to The Daily Beast. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Coming up, how a drug that delays puberty for young girls may be causing menopause-like symptoms in them now that they're young adults. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Thinning bones, cracked spines, deteriorating hip joints. These medical problems are pretty common symptoms of getting older. But for a small group of women, these health problems started in their 20s. The women have one thing in common. As young girls, they all took the drug Lupron to delay puberty or to help them grow taller. Christina Jewett is a senior correspondent with Kaiser Health News. She investigated Lupron's long-term effects as part of a partnership with Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting, and she joins us now. Welcome, Christina.
Thanks, Madeline.
Tell us about Lupron and what it was first prescribed for.
This was a drug that was initially approved for treatment of end-stage prostate cancer. So it essentially shuts off the testosterone in the man's body. So it cuts off that fuel source for these cancers that are related to hormones. Mm-hmm. So the prostate cancer, you know, won't grow.
So how did it migrate from that to be used on girls?
So the drug, it cuts off testosterone in men. It cuts off estrogen in women.
Okay. So you profiled some women who had these symptoms that I mentioned earlier. Can you tell us more about them?
I encountered this story helping out a colleague who was looking at some adverse medical events. And I saw that some of the symptoms with the kids were, you know, kind of surprising. So it just led me to dig deeper. And I found some online forums where people just talk about the symptoms that they're struggling with. And there was, you know, a lot of depression, bone problems, joint problems in these forums that were dominated by women who had taken this drug for endometriosis, who are older and, you know, perhaps more medically complex. But with kids, I mean, you know, a kid is, you know, a little bit more of a blank slate. So when I saw these young women in their 20s complaining of the same conditions and saying that they suspect it was because they too took Lupron, I thought that's sort of an amazing story, since this is something where parents often step in with the best of intentions to help a girl just look like her peers instead of looking a little bit older.
I wonder if you could just paint a picture of what some of these young women are going through.
Yeah, you know, I talked to a lot of them and it became kind of striking how similar the stories were. Joint pain, muscle pain, weakness, depression, anxiety, jaw joint dysfunction, like they talked about TMJ and having jaw joint surgeries, degenerative disc disease. I mean, having discs that were bulged where they hadn't, you know, had any kind of traumatic injury. So those things were really common.
And so this is well after they stopped taking the drugs.
Right, right. These women are in their 20s and, you know, approaching 30 now.
Yeah. And is this drug also given to boys?
That's more rare. They say that's about 10% of the cases. And usually with the boys, there's an underlying condition like a brain tumor or something else going on.
And so did you take your findings to the drug manufacturer for comment? And what did they say?
You know, we did. They said that the FDA approved the drug based on safety and efficacy studies that were done at the time. And, you know, that they report everything that they're aware of to the FDA in terms of adverse events. And the FDA did say that they had been undertaking a review of the drug, looking at seizures and psychiatric events related to the drug. And they haven't really, really said much since then. I know that they recently did send out a press release urging members of the public to report adverse events when they experience them, so the agency is able to track those better. You know, one of the challenges that the women have are that they have a sort of this revolving door of specialists they see with these sort of wide range of symptoms, and there's not really, you know, a GP for many of these women saying, you know, this was caused by the Lupron. Let's get to the root cause. It's really one of those things that the women are struggling to get answers themselves.
So again, the pediatricians who prescribed this, they had no idea that these possible side effects could happen years later.
Right. They didn't. And it was very difficult with this story because, as you could see, the doctors who treated the girls, you know, often said, well, yeah, you know, we don't see these patients 10 years later. So if this is happening, this might be something that's new. The joint problems, the depression, the anxiety, I mean, you know, it wasn't even a question in the studies. And then with the bone problems, there's some studies that say, yes, their bone density does go down, but then it's going to bounce back. And then there were other studies that weren't as positive as those findings.
So what do these women now say? Do they wish that they had never taken this drug?
Yeah, they do. I mean, the women said they wish they'd never taken it. The mothers say they wish they'd never injected their daughters. There's a lot of regret. I mean, you know, the parents don't want the girl to be different, right? To be, you know, developing sexually when all the other kids are not. But this is a painful injection that just the known side effects, the well-described side effects of sort of mood swings and pain at the injection site. I mean, one of the girls I talked to said just that, you know, she would have rather have been a little different than have to have dealt with feeling like a emotional wreck and having all this pain in her leg than, you know, dealing with early puberty. But I mean, but the flip side of that is that with the very young girls, you know, this is definitely a needed drug if you're looking at a 5-6 year old girl who's going into puberty.
But you can't know what your chances are of, you know, experiencing these negative side effects years later.
Right. And one of the things that I found interesting was that there was a suggestion in one of the warning labels for a version of the drug that doctors talk to girls about or families about discontinuing this drug at age 11. And several of the girls I talked to were on the drug after that point. So it's one of those things where I, you know, I really hope this story kind of spurs that research to see, you know, did I identify a subset of women who maybe had a certain common characteristics, or, you know, or is this just a broader problem that hasn't been identified?
Christina Jewett is a senior correspondent with Kaiser Health News. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot, Madeline.
All right, we want to hear from you. Did you take Lupron at a young age, and do you now have concerns about its long-term effects on your health? You can tell us about it on our Facebook page at KCRW Press Play. Coming up, why the truffle is such a must-have delicacy.
It's this undescribable flavor, this earthy, almost tree resin, chocolate-like aroma that was just so mysterious.
The story of a young truffle entrepreneur and his obsession, next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Truffles are pretty much the bling of the culinary world. A few years ago, 1 3-pounder went for $330,000. And like any industry with gobs of money, there are dark doings like fraud and double dealing. Ian Perkiastha has been steeped in the truffle business since he was a teenager. Now, at age 24, he has become one of the most sought-after importers of truffles. His company, Regalis, supplies most of the Michelin-starred restaurants in New York. He's out with a new memoir called Truffle Boy, My Unexpected Journey Through the Exotic Food Underground. And when I spoke to him, he pointed to one meal that started what he calls an obsession.
I had always loved to cook and loved to eat well. And on a visiting trip to Houston to see old friends, I was going out to dinner. And my friend's parents mentioned that I could order anything on the menu. And so we had moved to Arkansas in pursuit of a more frugal lifestyle. So when I saw this truffle ravioli dish on the menu at this restaurant, I knew this was going to be one of the seldom times I could try it. So I decided to order it. And it was a black truffle ravioli with a foie gras sauce. And from the moment I ate it, everything changed. I mean, it was just new and exciting flavor I had never experienced before. And I knew I wanted to replicate this again. So when I came back to Arkansas, I begged my parents to give in to buying me a truffle or two, and they flat out denied me. And so it basically jump-started this intense study on truffles. And I, for the next 6 months, just completely became immersed in wanting to learn everything I could about truffles. And it was this obsession, really. And I eventually pooled together my Christmas and birthday savings from several years to buy truffles I had found online. So this French truffle forager was willing to ship me some truffles to Arkansas. And so I bought a kilo of black summer truffle. And that's when they arrived several days later. And I realized, no, this is quite a lot of truffles. I better
You're not gonna eat
I
them
better
all.
Figure out something to do with them all. So I obviously kept several to cook with to replicate this ravioli dish, which was amazing. And then I decided to cold call the three local high-end restaurants in town. And so my dad drove me to these different restaurants, and I would hop out of the car, and I stopped at Target to buy a cheap kitchen scale and an invoice book, and I cold called these restaurants, and I was able to sell all of them. And I turned a very large profit, and it was exciting.
Is that what really set you on your path? Was it that incident?
It was, yeah. And so for the remainder of the summer, I was 15. So for the remainder of the summer, I kept bringing in larger and larger shipments, and my mom and dad would take turns every couple of weeks driving me down to Houston or Austin or so forth and local tri-state cities, and I would just hop out and cold call these different restaurants.
And what did they think when they saw a 15-year-old walk in with some truffles?
Well, I don't know if it was the novelty of this buck-tooth kid walking in with truffles or the fact that the truffles were just very good quality, but I was able to find success, and it was fun. I mean, my heroes were always chefs, and I had always loved cooking shows and so forth, and so it was just a really amazing experience to be able to walk into these kitchens and talk to these chefs.
If you could just describe what a truffle tastes like and why it was so enchanting to you.
It's this undescribable flavor, this earthy, almost tree resin, chocolate-like aroma that was just so mysterious and elusive. It's really hard to describe a truffle's aroma and fragrance, but it just totally, I don't know.
It just captivated you for some reason.
Totally.
More than any other food or anything else?
More than anything else. And it's been almost 10 years later, and it still is this amazing, wild ingredient that I'm just totally entrenched with.
Why is it such a delicacy? Why are truffles so rare?
So truffles are essentially the last or the only real wild, entirely wild ingredients still left in the world. I mean, they've never really successfully been cultivated on a commercial scale. The white have actually never been cultivated, not one single white truffle. And they grow underground. So trained dogs are used to find them.
I thought it was pigs that were...
Well, pigs have historically been used to find truffles, but they're quite difficult to control, and many truffle hunters were losing their fingers prying them from the pigs' mouths. So they've used dogs over the last 100 years. And actually, in Italy, pigs are outlawed, and they were destroying a lot of the main truffle producing regions. Truffles are extremely perishable as well. Once a truffle is found, if kept refrigerated, they typically last 5 to 7 days. So the clock is constantly ticking from the time it's pulled from the ground, which is also why they're so expensive. And then just in terms of sheer numbers, truffles are an item or an ingredient that are very, very scarce. There was about 25 tons of black winter truffle found this past year in France, which is pretty low in comparison to potatoes, for instance.
And they're normally found in Italy and in France?
A lot of truffles are actually found in these unknown, almost poverty-stricken areas, such as there's a passage in the book where I travel to Serbia in search of white truffles, because everyone thinks that white truffles come from this small town called Alba in Italy, when in reality the majority of them come from Eastern Europe, from Hungary, Serbia, Romania, Croatia, and are smuggled into the country and then sold as Italian white truffles. And the same with the winter black truffles from France. The majority of them actually grow in Spain. My hope with the book is also to demystify these ingredients and to really educate the reader on where these different ingredients are actually coming from.
Is that part of the reason why they're expensive? Is people are attaching this more glamorous provenance to them?
Well, I mean, white truffles in Serbia are still very expensive. This past year, I was paying $2,000 a pound for white truffles in Serbia and $2,500 a pound for white truffles in Italy. They definitely have a higher price tag when they have the Italian association. Mm-hmm. But in general, truffles are just quite expensive. I mean, the demand surpasses the supply, I mean, every year.
So that has led to, as you describe, a lot of crime and fraud in the business because
there's so much
demand for this rare commodity. How do you, if you are a truffle buyer, if you're a chef, how do you know if you're getting good truffles?
Well, there's actually not too much information out there for chefs. And so there are many chefs that actually get taken advantage of by other unscrupulous companies. There's many different varieties of truffles. There's about 15 different edible varieties that are quite popular in Europe. And of those 15, two are the most commonly associated with the white truffle and the black truffle. But it just comes to education. I mean, I think the reason why I've been successful in this industry is that I'm trying to educate chefs and where the truffles are coming from and what makes a good truffle great. And I think that's just something that isn't really focused on at the moment in this industry.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Ian Perkiastha about his new memoir. It's called Truffle Boy, My Unexpected Journey Through the Exotic Food Underground. Well, you had your own frustrations and setbacks, right? I mean, you partnered originally with an Italian man named Ubaldo Rossini, and that didn't end very well.
It didn't. I, in high school, started buying truffles from a French company early on, and then eventually I had quality issues, and so I sought a new supplier, and I had found this company in Italy that was wanting to start selling product in the U.S., and I formed this relationship with this company, and my senior year of high school, I was essentially selling product for them on commission, and it was going well. And I had found many customers across the U.S., and I had turned my parents' garage into a shipping center, and I would go to the airport after school two or three times a week to pick up fresh truffle shipments and then bring them back to the house and break them into smaller shipments and ship them all across the U.S. And with the profits that they had made my senior year of high school, I moved to New York, and they were able to open a little office for me in Newark, New Jersey, which was not amazing because I got robbed and beaten up on my third day outside of the office. But for the next several years, I was working for this company, building a client base, being paid on commission. And it got to the point where they thought I was making too much for my age, and it got to be a problem. And so I ended up leaving and eventually starting my own company, Regalis. And Regalis has been open for almost 6 years now.
So walk me through a typical day with you, because as you said, these are extremely perishable products. They last between, 5 and 7 days, as you said, from when they're dug up somewhere in Serbia or Spain or wherever you get them. And then you have to sell them to a chef in New York. So that's a very small window. What does your day look like?
I'm constantly on the grind. The truffles come in often two or three times a week to maximize their high quality and preserve that shelf life. So as soon as they come in, we pick them up at the airport, and then I sort through every single truffle. Half of them often are set aside for shipping out of New York. And then the other half I load up into my car or the van, and I start going to restaurants. I start cold calling, essentially. In New York in particular, no one seems to pre-order truffles. So I have to essentially bring in every single week what I think or what I can hope to sell. And I go from restaurant to restaurant selling truffles.
Kind of out of the back of your car?
Out of the back of my car, yeah. and obviously,
doesn't seem very glamorous for such a glamorous product.
It's not too glamorous, honestly. But it's amazing because it allows me to connect with these many amazing chefs and be in these amazing kitchens. It's a gateway to these other different products that I now procure from all around the world. It obviously started with truffles, and now we do caviar and lots of wild mushrooms and foraged edibles and exotic live seafoods and proteins and so forth. But the portfolio is still pretty small. So what usually happens is that we now have four delivery trucks. The really large deliveries are delivered by truck, and then the very small, precious caviar and truffle deliveries are usually delivered by me in person. That's really what it takes, because every year there's more and more competition, and there's more and more people that think there's a lot of money to be made in the truffle industry that will smuggle truffles back and forth from Europe and do this exact same thing, go to restaurants and have a little cooler bag full of truffles and walk up to these different chefs and pitch them their wares.
Do they ever make you a meal as a thank you?
Totally. That's one of the biggest perks in the industry. on restaurant deliveries, there will usually be a chef that will cook something for you. Obviously, that doesn't happen every delivery, but the real happiness for me comes from going to these different restaurants and really seeing how these amazing chefs are using the ingredients. And I get pretty well hooked up, which is amazing. Lots of free food. It's great.
But you still remember that first meal, the black truffle.
I do. And it was, to this day, still the most amazing thing I've ever had.
Ian Perkiasta, he's the author of a new memoir. It's called Truffle Boy, My Unexpected Journey Through the Exotic Food Underground. And coming up on this program, it is not your imagination. Your internet at home is slower than it's supposed to be. We're going to find out why next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brown. How often do you go online, click on something, and then wait for seemingly forever for the page to load or the video to play? It is not your imagination that internet speeds are slow, perhaps slower than they used to be. And that's despite companies advertising fast speeds. Well, in New York State, Attorney General Eric Schneiderman is suing Charter Communications. That's the company that owns Spectrum, formerly Time Warner Cable.
The company built its multi-million-dollar ad campaigns around promises of fast and reliable service. But the reality is that their internet service was neither fast nor reliable. It is a consistent story of bad performance and a long-term business plan built on deceit.
Built on deceit. That's in New York. But Spectrum is also the biggest cable provider here in Southern California. And here to tell us more about this story is LA Times consumer columnist David Lazarus. Hi there.
I thought we were going to talk about truffles.
That was the last interview. We're all done with that.
Let's move on.
Okay, so apparently Schneiderman spent 16 months investigating Charter Communications and Spectrum and found that it was, as he said, a company built on deceit. What is he talking about?
What he's talking about is evidence, apparently internal documents, emails, and other such things, showing that Charter bigwigs were aware of the fact that they could not deliver on the advertised speeds they were promising for broadband internet. Specifically, the lawsuit alleges that Charter was leasing modems and routers to people that simply could not hit these top speeds. They were old hardware. Moreover, Charter was aware of network improvements that could be made that would ease congestion that they didn't make. And this is what Schneiderman is getting at, is that basically high-speed internet users in New York were buying a pig in a poke. And then the question becomes, well, if that's what was happening with the 2.5 million Spectrum customers there, what about here?
And how many of them are there here?
Well, there's a whole bunch, because Time Warner Cable was the dominant cable provider here in Southern California. It's estimated now that Charter and its Spectrum service, if you roll in both the L.A. area, the San Diego area, more than a third of all pay TV households are Charter customers.
Okay, so what does the company say about this? Do they have an answer?
They want to talk about the California side of things. When I asked them for a comment, they said, first of all, we're really disappointed about the New York thing, but they didn't deny it, which I thought was very telling. Normally, a company will come out and say, oh, we're shocked to discover that our internet speeds are not very fast. They just said we're disappointed. They also patted themselves on the back for making a whole bunch of investments since they acquired Time Warner Cable, but that doesn't necessarily say that anything in the lawsuit is wrong. And when I asked Charter specifically, well, the allegations in New York, does that in any way reflect on California? And they just declined to comment.
Well, how much slower than advertised is the average internet connection?
Well, according to the lawsuit, they were finding that for the wired connections, you know, that's the cable coming straight into your computer, it could be as much as 70% slower than the than the advertised price. For Wi-Fi connections, it could be as much as 80% slower. And that's, you take that with a grain of salt, because Wi-Fi is always going to be a little bit slower because, you know, it's jumping out into the air. Nevertheless, when I did a test in my house, and I'm a Spectrum customer, I pay for 100 megabits per second. And that's a pretty darn good speed, because I got a teenager in the house and he's a gamer, and I would catch heck if we didn't have all that speed. So I'm hoping to get somewhere near 100 Mbps, and instead, when I checked it, it was 44 Mbps.
Wow.
Now, granted, that's the Wi-Fi rate, but I'm only 5 feet from the router, so are you kidding me?
Well, what can you do about it?
Well, there's several things. I mean, you can look at an equipment upgrade, a better router, a better modem. That's going to be money out of your pocket. You can also shop around for a different provider, but the reality is you just need to kind of take it that when you are buying residential internet service, it's coming on an as-is basis. And in the past, Time Warner Cable used to advertise their speeds as up to, say, 10 Mbps or 100 Mbps. Well, those two words, up to, big weasel words here, because it could mean anything. I've noticed that Charter, since they've taken over, have dropped the up to thing, but instead, if you click through to a few levels of disclaimer, it says that some of their customers will get less than the advertised speed, and if Schneiderman is to be believed, more than some, quite a few.
Well, how much of it is under their control? In other words, what about outside forces like telephone lines, for example, that they can't really control?
Well, fair enough. But, I mean, it's basically the way the network works. It's a cable, and so the more people who are drinking from that cable, mm-hmm. the less there is to go around. So, obviously, if you go online at prime time, when a lot of people might be watching Netflix or, you know, doing gaming or whatnot, it's going to be more congested. And that's just the reality of running a network. If you go on at an uncongested time, you would expect it to be faster. But when I did my little test at home, I did it Monday morning, and that's not a very congested time. I think the fact is that it's a product that's not being sold accurately. And I think that's the heart of what Schneiderman is getting at, is that when you promise super fast speeds and are unable to deliver, you have not adequately disclosed that there are going to be barriers to that. And some of them are within the service's power to deal with, and some of them are not. But it's all about disclosure.
So there's a new chair of the FCC and appointed by Donald Trump. What does his appointment mean for dealing with issues like this?
You know, he's not exactly the most consumer-friendly guy. His name is Ajit Pai. He knows telecom. Make no mistake. He's been around the FCC for quite some time. No one disputes his bona fides when it comes to knowing the terrain. But that said, this guy's a deregulation kind of guy. He does not feel that the heavy hand of government should be involved with your cell phone company, your cable company, various telecom companies. And so he's already been making noises about wanting to go in completely the opposite direction of his predecessor, Tom Wheeler. For example, net neutrality, mm-hmm. which is all about internet access providers treating all content providers the same. Well, he's not a big fan of having to regulate that. Tom Wheeler was also keen to crack down on set-top boxes and the crazy fees that often get leveraged with those. Ajit Pai wants to move back from that. And also, and I think this is the real biggie, is under Wheeler, the internet and high-speed internet specifically was regulated as a utility. This is a new thing because that had never been the case before, and that's what put it under the FCC's jurisdiction. I think it's very likely that Ajit Pai is going to step back from that and allow high-speed internet to, in fact, not be regulated as a utility, but to instead be regulated as an information service, which means there will be far fewer rules for the industry to have to follow.
David Lazarus, consumer columnist at the LA Times. Thank you.
Always a pleasure.
Hi, Julie Myers.
Hello.
What do you have for us?
Well, I'm commandeering the listener segment today to talk about a special event we have coming up at the end of February.
Yes.
It's February 28th at 6 p.m. It's an event called Breaking Point, Housing Density in the Future of L.A. This is done, we're talking about Measure S, which is coming up on the ballot. Mm-hmm. Voters in Los Angeles are going to vote on that on March 7th. And we're talking about the people who are in support of Measure S, the people that are against it. This is an anti-development measure that's
going to
be on
the ballot.
Yeah, maybe
you've seen the billboards.
That's right. They're going up all over the place. Mm-hmm. Neighbors are turning on neighbors. It's very, very contentious. Anyway, we're going to talk about Measure S. We're also going to talk about some other housing issues. who gets to live here, how we live, what the future is.
And you can come, and it's free.
That's exactly right. So I'm going to post this on our Facebook page, which is KCRW Press Play, in just a minute, and you can RSVP. It's in Hollywood at the Barnstall Gallery Theater. Again, that's February 28th at 6 p.m. We want you to be there, so jump on our Facebook page in just a minute and RSVP.
Okay. Thank you. All right. Mm-hmm. That was a good public service announcement.
I am super servicey.
You certainly are, with an S. That's Julie Myers. Thanks for listening. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.